tonight on Arena. Rebecca on the Rocks and Summer of 85 with the movies up for review, and Elizabeth Thompson on her new book, June Boye's The Last Leaf. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, you've guessed it. Sean Rock's back in the seat. And indeed, big thanks to Kay Sheehy and the Arena team for stepping into the breach at very short notice for the last few days. And it's Joan Baez, by the way, that we'll be talking about later in the programme, not June Baez, whoever she is. When I was last with you, on Friday last, in fact, we had the chair of the International Dublin Literary Award, Chris Morash, in with us, taking us through the 10 shortlisted titles for this year's award. You might have heard on the news at one today that 2020 gave us an Irish winner. Anna Burns, author of Milkman, has won the award of €100,000. Winning that prize fund, the world's largest, will add to the accolades Burns has already received for the novel, including her 2018 Man Booker Prize win. Let's listen to the opening passage of Milkman, read here by Shauna Kerslake.
The day somebody, McSomebody, put a gun to my breast and called me a cat and threatened to shoot me was the same day the milkman died. I don't know whose milkman he was. He wasn't our milkman. I don't think he was anybody's. He didn't take milk orders. There was no milk about him. He didn't ever deliver milk. Also, he didn't drive a milk lorry. Instead, he drove cars. Different cars, often flash cars, though he himself was not flashy. For all this, though, I only noticed him and his cars when he put himself in them in front of me. He appeared one day driving up in one of his cars as I was walking along reading Ivanhoe. Often I would walk along reading books. I didn't see anything wrong with this, but soon it became something else to be added as further proof against me. Reading while walking was definitely on the list. You're one of the Hoosits girls, aren't you? So-and-so was your father, wasn't he? Your brother's Thingy and Thingy used to play in the hurling team, didn't they? Hop in. I'll give you a lift.
Shauna Kerslake there, reading from the opening passage of Milkman, the book which was announced earlier today as the winner of this year's International Dublin Literary Award. The long list for the award is made up of books nominated by libraries worldwide, and in her acceptance speech, Anna Burns recalled her own experience of libraries growing up in Belfast.
Libraries have always been important to me. I have prominent memories of my childhood Saturdays when I would go to the library with my aunt and we'd make good on our tickets, and oftentimes not just our own or even our own. There seemed to be a black market in library tickets when I was growing up. No one seemed to have their own, yet managed to go into the building with about 3 to 5 cards and come out with about 9 to 15 books. So I thank too the lovely Old Park Library in North Belfast and the Central Library in downtown Belfast, not just for playing a huge role in my reading life, but for letting everybody away with being a different person from whom their library cards that week were saying they were. Libraries are good sports, and to go from being a wee girl haggling over library cards with my siblings, my friends, neighbours, my parents and my aunt, to be standing here today receiving this award is phenomenal for me, and I thank you all again for this great honour.
Well, who knew that library cards could cause such things to happen? Anna Burns there accepting the International Dublin Literary Award for her novel Milkman, and many, many congratulations to her. Well, here we are coming to the end of day one, level 5, more restricted in our movements, but it's film reviews on Thursday night and they will all be available, the three that we're speaking about digitally. I'll give you the details of where you can look at them at home over the coming days and weeks if you so wish. What are we speaking about tonight? Ben Wheatley brings us a sumptuous version of Rebecca. Sofia Coppola is back with the actor she calls her muse, Bill Murray, in a film called On the Rocks. And Francois Ozon brings us a coming-of-age tale called Summer of 85. Angela Flannery and John Maguire have been looking at the movies and they join me now. We'll start with Rebecca, the Daphne du Maurier novel of 1938, gothic novel about a young bride haunted by the memory that others have, in fact, of her alluring predecessor, who's the Rebecca of the novel's title. This new film stars Armie Hammer and Lily James as Mr. and the new Mrs. De Winter, and Kristen Scott Thomas as scheming housekeeper Mrs. Danvers. Angela, there's the novel for starters, but really the bar is set very high on this film, particularly when we think of Hitchcock's version of the novel, his film, his 1940 film. It's the one that you kind of have to mark yourself up to, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's right. The 1940 Oscar-winning film. Hitchcock's adaptation of the du Maurier novel was just spectacular. I remember seeing it myself as a teenager and being blown away, absolutely terrified by it. Not so much because it was a horror, but because of just how psychologically manipulative it was, and Mrs. Danvers in particular. So, you know, Olivier and Fontaine, just quite incredible. So how to make this again, you really, really are taking on a huge challenge, because comparisons are just going to be inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to mention Joan Fontaine in the part, and Lily James now has to occupy the new Mrs. De Winters, who's never named actually anything other than the new Mrs. De Winters, Olivier as Maxime De Winter, the Armie Hammer part. And Judith Anderson, it was, who played the Mrs. Danvers character in that Hitchcock film version, wasn't it? Kristen Scott Thomas having to take over that mantle. Like, there's three incredible performances to follow. I suppose the first thing is the chemistry between the new Mrs. De Winter and Mr. De Winter, Lily James and Armie Hammer. First of all, is there enough there? Because they run off with each other in two shakes of a lamb's tail, really, John, don't they?
They do. It's good. The first part of the film is follows very closely to du Maurier's original plot. And Hitchcock was restrained back in 1940 when he was brought over to the States for his first American film. He wasn't allowed to touch the script. The Hays Code had gone over Selznick's script and said that you can film that, but you can film no more. Whereas Wheatley today can film the entire story. And there's a crucial plot point that Hitchcock couldn't use that Wheatley has available to him. But even that close following of the original story doesn't inject... There's more chemistry in a salt cellar, Sean, than there is on screen here. This is an unfortunate film in that it's a high-end A-list Netflix adaptation. And all the elements are there. The young heroine in love, the man with secrets, a haunted mansion, the murder mystery, the villainous villain, one of the most indelible in all of English literature. And somehow Wheatley comes up short. And it is fundamentally a problem with casting. Lily James isn't miscast, but she's poorly directed. But Armie Hammer is miscast. He's as wooden and as unbending as his name would suggest.
Oh, dear. You're in very bad mood on this Thursday evening.
There are elements to the film that I really enjoyed.
Okay,
but
what you look
for is atmosphere and passion. And that's what Olivier would have brought to the role.
And you weren't
getting
that.
And Armie Hammer can't do that.
In fact, you don't say... John's saying there, Angela, that Lily James is not miscast. She's just badly directed. You did feel she was miscast.
Yeah, I really did. And as John says, it's not that she's not playing the part. I mean, she can act, but she should never have been cast in the role of the second Mrs. De Winter, who's supposed to be drab and mousy and, you know, naive. She's a middle-class woman who is taken on as a travelling companion by this odious American Mrs. Van Hopper, you know, so she is supposed to be totally swept off her feet. But you look at Lily James, and I mean, she's absolutely exquisite, and the wardrobe that she's given is exceptional. It really reminded me of The Talented Mr. Ripley, you know, very, very highly stylized. Like, the clothes are fantastic, her hair is beautiful. I mean, this really isn't a mousy woman. And there's also a sex on the beach scene that completely does away with any idea that she could be an innocent who has no idea what she's in for.
It's also in colour, which I think means we see those costumes in a way that we wouldn't see them in a black and white film. But let's listen to a clip that features Lily James in that part. And if you thought she had difficulties with the person who she was working for in the early part of the film, she then goes to Manderley and meets Mrs. Danvers, who in this film is played by Kristen Scott Thomas. And the new Mrs. De Winter has been rummaging around in the bedrooms, and Mrs. Danvers comes in and is none too happy to find her moving things around the place.
I'd brush her hair for her every evening. Come on, Danny, hair drill, she'd say. I'd stand behind her and brush away for 20 minutes at a time. That great mass of dark hair. He joined in. He loved to do that for her. He'd be dressing for dinner, guests waiting downstairs. Harder, Max, harder! And he'd roar with laughter. And he was always laughing like then. Does he brush your hair?
No. Mrs. Danvers, does Mr. De Winter ask you to keep the room like this?
He doesn't have to. She's still here. Can you feel her? I wonder what she's thinking about you, taking her husband and using her name.
There you go. Kristen Scott Thomas as Mrs. Danvers and Mrs. De Winter. The new Mrs. De Winter, played by Lily James in that scene from the up-to-date version, the Ben Wheatley version of Daphne du Maurier's novel, Rebecca. John, I mentioned to Angela, you know, the idea that I just said just as we're going into that clip, this idea of everything's in colour and everything does look amazing. But what I remember specifically from that Hitchcock film was the kind of the dankness, the fog was grey, the whole thing was grey and black and white. And it kind of added to the atmosphere in a way that you just don't get that atmosphere in this colour version.
Well, yeah, I think you do get a sense of it at the start when you have the character that Lily James is second Mrs. De Winter was working for has this ornate lifestyle in the hotel in
Monte Carlo.
This
is Mrs. Van Hopper.
Mrs. Van Hopper.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
so she's surrounded by these flowers and you get a sense of that overwhelming kind of perfume of that kind of corruption that's in, you know, that flowers are literally rotting in front of us. So there he can, Wheatley can find the atmosphere that you're looking for, that suggestive atmosphere. But when we arrive in Manderley, it's kind of, it turns into Downton Abbey, unfortunately. There's none of that gothic that you're looking for. There's no darkness in the shadow, and where the best character and the best performance in the film, Kirsten Scott Thomas, Mrs. Danvers, she lives in those shadows and we don't really get a sense of them. It's kind of Art Deco and it's beautifully designed and beautifully dressed, but it's very difficult to locate the atmosphere that you're looking for in a gothic novel, the ultimate modern gothic novel.
Yeah, and I suppose comparisons are odious in some ways, Angela, because we should judge it on its own merits. Does it bring a kind of a reading to the novel, a reading of this story that brings something new and something different?
No, I don't think that it does, actually, because what it really lacks, Jonathan, is that darkness. But also with the novel, you know, there's a lot of sexual ambiguity. There's a lot of moral ambiguity in it. And really, I don't think that we get that at all in this version, and particularly with Danvers. You know, she's just not deranged enough. Now, I do agree that Kristen Scott Thomas actually is the saving grace of this. I enjoyed watching this. I mean, the 2 hours flew by, but it was sort of like, you know, Great British Interiors I was watching. And, oh, look at her dress and her hair fab. You know, I mean, I wasn't sitting there feeling really uncomfortable and kind of saying, I mean, I don't think I'm giving anything away here, but really you're an innocent who marries this guy and now he admits this thing to you. And great, let's just move on around Europe for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just doesn't have that moral ambiguity and absolutely glosses over any sense of sexual tension there between Danvers and the late Rebecca, which, you know, kind of made it fall short for me. If you like Downton Abbey, you'll love this. And it was entertaining. I did enjoy it, but it's not Rebecca.
All right. So stars from you, Angela, on the basis of that.
3, because you'll enjoy it. People sit down to watch this on Netflix, I think it will entertain them and it's beautiful to look at. But just, if you've never read Rebecca or you've never seen the Hitchcock version, you'll like this. It's just an entirely different beast.
Okay. And what are you saying, John?
I'd go along with Angela. It's not an essential adaptation of the film. Hitchcock did that 80 years ago, but it's not as bad as we've just made it out to be. So I'd say 3 stars.
Yeah, so
I'd
judge it on its own merits. Don't be looking for another version. Go, if you want to see the Hitchcock film, watch that. But this is, should
watch
be seen
the Hitchcock,
on its
exactly.
own merits. What did you say, John? Sorry, stars, I missed
3
that.
Stars. I
three stars.
Three
so you're both saying yeah. both saying 3 in terms of Rebecca. Let's move on then to On the Rocks, 8th feature film from director Sofia Coppola. Reunites with the man she calls her muse, Bill Murray. Father-daughter relationship is what's at the heart of this. Bill Murray, Angela, he's playing a character here called Felix. Who is he and what's his relationship with his daughter? She's a writer, isn't she? The character played by Rashida Jones?
That's right. Yeah, Laura's a writer. She's living in New York with her husband and two beautiful young daughters. She's got writer's block and she's kind of getting a bit tired of the humdrum day-to-day of the school run and childcare and all of that. She seems to have a perfect marriage. Her husband, Dean, played by Marlon Wayans, starts to behave in a way that she considers, you know, a bit odd, and he's a little bit distant, travelling a lot for work. And then Laura meets Dean's new co-worker, who happens to be very, very attractive. And a couple of things don't add up. So she decides, jumps to, you know, the obvious conclusion that, well, he's sleeping with the co-worker. So she makes the mistake of telling her father, Felix, played by Bill Murray, as you say, about this. And the two of them go off on this mad escapade to, you know, catch Dean in the act.
Yeah, it's kind
and
of a,
prove.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Kind of an amateur sleuth feeling to what they're doing, in fact. And the guy wanted, because you were mentioning there how she tells her dad about what's going on. Let's listen to a clip between the two of them then, Rashida Jones and Bill Murray, where they're kind of trying to work out what might he have been at in the hotel he was in.
So Dean's going away a lot, huh? On business trips?
Dad, not everyone is like you.
Where was he coming back from when he was acting so strange?
London.
London. Where was he staying?
I think it was Blake's.
Blake's?
Blake's, yeah. Why?
Blake's is a cozy, little, off-the-beaten-track hotel that I wouldn't stay at if I were on a business trip.
Huh.
I know a concierge over at Claridge's. He knows all the concierges. When was he there?
Last week, but let's not get carried away, okay? There was something.
What?
Never mind.
What?
There were some of his co-workers' toiletries in his luggage.
Sloppy move.
But she couldn't put them in her carry-on through security, so he offered to put them in his luggage. That's it.
Raise your hand if that sounds fishy.
You know what? I shouldn't have said anything. Forget it.
Bill Murray and Rashida Jones there in a scene from On the Rocks and John Maguire. You know, that in some ways sounds like almost like a little kind of detective story, or that they're just going to be, that it could be a screwball comedy where they're trying to work out whether her husband is having an affair or not. But I'm guessing this probably moves more into the dynamic of father and daughter rather than getting lost in plot points.
Well, it is curious that Coppola, the daughter of Francis Ford Coppola, is so drawn to these kind of father-daughter stories. If you remember a film from a few years ago called Sometimes that she made, and it is a source of endless fascination for her. But this is a very warm and a very witty film, and she's drawn inspiration more from Woody Allen and Neil Simon to deliver a series of Valentines, really, to Manhattan, first of all, to motherhood, to fathers and daughters, and to Bill Murray. It's really Bill Murray's show. As soon as he arrives, about 8 minutes into the film, he just takes over. He takes the film becomes his film. And the title refers to how he takes his whiskey and also how Laura is beginning to think of the state of her marriage. And it's going to be tricky for us to describe the plot because I think we've kind of described it. There's not a huge amount to it. But what you have here is a hangout film. It's the two of them hanging around together, spending time together. The issues that they're talking about are especially sensitive since Murray's character, Felix, years before had left Laura's mother for another woman and has been this kind of playboy philanderer enjoying his retirement ever since. The joy of it is in that naturalistic portrayal of this loving, complicated father and daughter relationship.
Well, in fact, you've kind of explained part of the character, you know, that he is this playboy, Lothario about town thing. And some of his attitudes on the dynamics between males and females are very interesting. The character Felix. This is basically a Bill Murray monologue, but pretending he's a character called Felix.
You know what's interesting? Back when humans walked on all fours, it was the sight of the female haunches that excited them. So that when we finally stood up on two legs, it was the women with the rounded breasts that mirrored the haunches that were most exciting to the males. So they made babies with them, and eventually that shape evolved into what is our modern female.
Huh, wow.
And men were attracted to adolescent females because they were easier to catch, therefore ultimately easier to mate. And slowly over time, these qualities, small size, smooth skin, high voice, little or no beard, evolved into the qualities most desired today.
So they prefer no beard. Good to know.
Like you.
No beard is essential, it would seem, according to Bill Murray. And I like Angela, I like her reaction there. Okay, she makes the no beard comment at the end, but just wow in the middle. I kind of found myself saying wow once or twice during that. What does that tell us about the character and what he thinks, and how much of that is tongue in cheek, if any?
Well, that's definitely the best line in the film. I mean, look, you know, he's charismatic and he's incorrigible and he's what we call in Ireland, oh, he's an awful man, you know, that type of person. But at the end of the night, if you get stuck at a bar with him, they start becoming a bit of a bore. That's how I felt about this. And I love Bill Murray and I love New York and I love Chet Baker, and that's the soundtrack. And about 20 minutes into this, I kind of thought, oh, please don't make this one monologue after another. You know, just Bill Murray, Bill Murray, Bill Murray. And that's what it was. It was a two-hander. I got very, very bored with it. But anyway, yeah, what kind of character is he? He's that type of, you know, old school, outdated, outmoded, sexist attitude. But he's just got so much charisma and he's so funny and incorrigible that you kind of go along with it. And when she eventually snaps with him, it's when he says that he's finally become deaf to the pitch of women's voices. And, you know, her only kind of, the only time she pulls her father up is she says to him, well, look, you've got daughters and granddaughters, so you better figure out how to hear women. And that's as far as it goes. And it feels like an inserted nod to the Me Too movement or something. Like, it's just so clunky. I really expected to like this and I really didn't.
So you're disappointed. How does that translate into stars for you then, Angela?
Two.
And it sounds as if it was hard for you to give that to. What are you saying, John?
Oh, I liked it a lot more than Angela did. I think Murray steals every scene. He's freeform and unpredictable. I do think he gets his comeuppance, and I do think it's more cleverly threaded through the story than Angela did. But it's really Jones's film and her struggle with life and work and motherhood and her sense of herself, her lack of confidence, and those long simmering family resentments. That's what made the film sing for me. I thought it was great. I gave it 4 stars.
Oh, very big difference of opinion.
Yeah, no,
then
I thought it was great.
Now that's one certainly for a discussion between men and women, it would seem, on the rocks. 2 and 4 stars respectively. Let's move on then to our final film, Summer of 85, from French film maker François Ozon, based on the young adult novel from Aidan Chambers, Dance on My Grave. Summer of 85 tells the story of an intense first love for teenager Alex, who we meet in police custody and we don't know why. What kind of Europe are we in? What kind of relationship is being discussed or being explored in this relationship, John?
It's the Plastic Bertrand music video, basically, Sean. It's Normandy. It's 1985. Everybody is wearing pastel colours and has highlights in their hair. It's years before the internet was even considered. And kids were doing the things that kids do, hanging around together, getting into trouble, sailing boats, swimming in the sea. And Ozon, for quite a long time, would have us believe that Alexis, the character played by Felix Lefebvre, is the chief suspect in the death of his 18-year-old boyfriend, David Gorman, played by Benjamin Voisin, who's a newcomer and gives an excellent performance here. But before we settle that issue, we have to flash back to the summer just past, this 6 weeks when the two met and fell in love. David had saved Alexis from a capsized boat, taken him home to his mother, played by Valeria Bruni Tedeschi, who's a veteran actor, was mostly wasted here, unfortunately, and given him a job at their sailing tackle shop. The kid is in a bit of crisis. The younger boy is in a bit of crisis. He doesn't know what to do, whether he'll go to school, whether he'll get a job with his father on the docks. And on these long motorcycle spins and trips to the fun fair and et cetera, the two form this close bond, broken only by the arrival of a third wheel English teenager, an au pair played by Philippine Velge, who's working in the town as well.
So that adds, we have a kind of a triangle and all sorts of jealousies, etc., start to build up. The sex scenes here, a decidedly French sensibility, I think you were referring to it as, Angela.
Yeah. I thought they were really, really well handled, you know. I'm familiar with the writer, Aidan Chambers. You know, he's a YA, a young adult author, and I was surprised nobody's adapted this film before. And I think the reason the British might have stayed away from it is because of the sex. In fact, I'm convinced that that's why they stayed away from it. Because
is this the same sex relationship that you think the British would have avoided?
Yeah, I kind of think so. I think so, because I could imagine this book, if it was adapted, it would be very much, you know, a social realist film in the British tradition, and it would be preoccupied by class, and it would be quite gritty, you know. But with a French filmmaker, it becomes something else entirely. Now, maybe the accents of the actors might have given away a bit more about their class. It is a kind of down at heel resort that they're in, you know, and all of that. But it doesn't focus on that. It really focuses on the kind of sensuality and the coming of age and the sexual discovery. And there's absolutely nothing gratuitous about it. It's beautifully filmed. I found it really moving, really, really tender. And I think anybody, regardless of your sexual orientation, would be able to relate to that teenage experience. It just, you know, I really enjoyed watching it.
There were tone shifts.
Very well done.
There were tone shifts, John, that you found quite problematic.
I did. I think Ozon has done this kind of material better previously in his career. Now, I subsequently discovered that he's 30 years waiting to make this film. It's a passion project of his and something that he's always wanted to do. And he's playing with the tropes of the psychological thriller in this elaborately tricky structure that he gives us, which really is completely unnecessary and doesn't reveal much, or didn't reveal much to me, about the nature of the kind of characters that he's dealing with. And the key plot points are very coyly revealed. But even putting all of that aside, eventually he is completely overwhelmed by his preference for nostalgia over narrative. And I like the nostalgia. I would have been in my early teens in 1985, and all the songs and all the clothes and the discos and everything else is very familiar to me. But there's a kind of an unwelcome note of camp that undercuts the depth of the story, even as it thrashes around through all these tonal shifts and unlikely contrivances. And it damaged the film for me. I didn't like it as much as Angela did.
Well, so how does that translate into stars, John?
Just two for me, I'm afraid. Just two.
Not essential Ozon. I think you have a difference of opinion, or we have a difference of opinion on our hand here as well. Overall, what are you saying about Summer of 1985, Angela, and stars?
Yeah, look, I really enjoyed this. I thought that it was there was a very light touch to it, which I really just found it very authentic, totally unpretentious, and it brought me back to the summer of 1985. I would be biased because I was in my mid-teens at the time. The music, everything, like, he absolutely perfectly nailed the sounds, the smell. I was just there completely. I disagree about the structure with John, because I think it was really interesting for, you know, the interested English teacher to say to Alex, why don't you write your story? And that's how we're getting it in installments when he eventually starts opening up. I thought that was an interesting way of telling it. So yeah, I'm probably biased because I'm of that era, but I'm giving it 4.
Yeah, but there you go. You're both of that era. And yet we get 2 stars from John and 4 from Angela. That's for Summer of 85. That's available across video on demand platforms. On the Rocks, the second film we spoke about, is on Apple TV Plus from tomorrow. And Rebecca is released on Netflix. John McGuire and Angela Flannery are reviewers on this Thursday evening. Joan Baez, singer, songwriter and civil rights activist, turns 80 next week, like John Lennon, whose birthday we celebrated here in Arena a couple of weeks back. She is an iconic figure who will forever be associated with the 1960s, in her case, with the folk revival, with Bob Dylan, and with singing this alongside Martin Luther King in 1963 at the March on Washington. Joan Baez alongside Martin Luther King and a lot of other singing, obviously, at the 1963 March on Washington. And Joan Baez, The Last Leaf, is a new biography of her extraordinary life. Its author, Elizabeth Thompson, joins me now. Let's talk, first of all, Elizabeth, about your own connection to the music of Joan Baez and your own almost accidental discovery of it as a teenager.
Yes, very weird. I mean, I was given a guitar and I had to learn to play it, a genuine Spanish guitar, by my sister's boss. She was working in Spain and he sent it from El Corte Inglés in Barcelona. And I was 11 years old, I think. In that summer between primary school and secondary school, I had to learn to play it. A neighbour showed me four chords and I found in my sister's collection this record, Joan Baez Volume 2. I'd never heard of her. And interestingly, Maureen had no recollection of ever having bought it. But the back cover showed this young woman sitting in dappled shade playing a Spanish guitar. So I thought, oh, well, that's hopeful. So I put it on a heavy old Vanguard record. And out came things like Barbara Allen and Banks of the Ohio and Plaisida Moore. And then some more difficult things like The Trees They Grow High, which had too many bar chords. But you know, things like Barbara Allen, I could do that, four or five chords. You know, I'd learned that. And then I began exploring further rather by the school library. And then I thought, wow, this woman has the most amazing voice. And then as I explored a little bit further in those old analog days, you remember when we had to go to libraries and so on and actual record shops to listen, I discovered this record of her fifth album, Joan Baez Volume 5 from 1964, which had this amazing track called Bacchanalas Brasileiras on it, which I did not try to copy because it's for eight cellos and soprano, a fusion of Bach with Brazilian folk song. And I thought, wow, this woman can really sing. And then I began to realize you just played that clip of her leading a quarter of a million people in song on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I realized that she'd been a part of some very significant moments that were then very recent history. This was 1969. The March on Washington was just 6 years previously. Martin Luther King had been dead a year when I began researching all this. And I realized that Baez was sort of a zealot figure, or if you like, a kind of Venn diagram through which I could explore not just the music of the American 60s and 70s as they unfolded, but American social history. And that's what I did.
Yeah, that's what the book does. And it's almost impossible, and certainly it's the tack you take in the book to separate Baez and her music from her activism. And that, I think, the apple, as they say, doesn't fall far from the tree. That started at home with her parents, in particular her father, Albert.
Yes, I mean, very, very interesting background, I think. I was actually the first time I met her properly in 1980. I was at a press conference. She'd just done the big campaign for the boat people. And an English journalist named Derek Jewell said, "What do you understand, Miss Baez, by the saying charity begins at home?" And she said, "Well, I understand that to mean what your parents teach you." He meant, why are you worried about the boat people in the South China Sea, you know? So she's the granddaughter of ministers on both sides of her family, Scottish Episcopalian on her mother's. Her mother was born in Edinburgh. And a Catholic Mexican on her father's side, who grandfather left the Catholic Church to become a Methodist minister and was, I think, exiled from the family. And in fact, what I hadn't known until I began researching this, that he and his wife, known as Mother B and Father B, they was a really key figure in the Latin population in Brooklyn, which was the center then of the Hispanic community. And he established the first Spanish-speaking Methodist Episcopalian church in Brooklyn. And they were both really key figures for the Latino community. And they set up a summer camp in the Hudson, in the Walker Valley up in New York State for, you know, Hispanic children who would not otherwise have had a chance to leave the city and experience the outdoors. And they raised funds to take children up there, and the grandfather ran it until he died in 1965.
Yeah. And as you say, Joan certainly picked up a lot of her attitudes, left-leaning attitudes in the family, and that often landed the father in trouble. Let's listen to her singing.
Yes.
At one level, nothing more than a folk song involved here, but the once you listen to the lyrics, you think there's no such thing as nothing more than a folk song.
Yeah.
I took the train to Richmond, it fell. It was a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were singing, they went.
The sound of the voice of Joan Baez there and the live version of The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. And speaking with me this evening is Elizabeth Thompson, author of a book called Joan Baez, The Last Leaf. I suppose if we really want to start with the musical career of Joan Baez, Elizabeth, it is 1959, the Newport Folk Festival. I don't know if they were, were they quite electric at that stage? I don't know if Dylan had caused us trouble at that point in time.
No, there were 6 years to go before
before he caused that trouble. So she was very much an acoustic artist and very much in that folk vein. It wasn't even introduced. She was just put on the stage and off she went type of thing.
Yes, I mean, she'd made the continuation of our last bit of our chat was that, of course, her father was a co-inventor of the X-ray microscope, and he found himself being asked to use science for defence or offensive purposes. And in an effort to kind of calm his conscience, he became a Quaker. And so the whole family went to Quaker meetings. So it was a peripatetic childhood, and it so happened that the last move she made with her family was to Boston, where her father, Cambridge, really. Her father had a kind of portfolio career of jobs at MIT and so on. So she was hanging around Harvard Square at 17, 18, supposed to be studying drama at Boston University, but actually I think she went for about 5 minutes. So she flunked it, as she always said, but she was beginning to sing in, most famously, Club 47. And this was the moment, you know, the Kingston Trio had taken Tom Dooley to the top of the charts. This was the moment when the folk revival was what every cool college kid was interested in. So there were coffee shops, as there still are quite a few around Harvard Yard. And she very quickly established herself as, you know, someone to watch. And it was Dylan's manager, actually, Albert Grossman, who wanted to manage her. She didn't want to be managed by him eventually. But he had a club, in a very famous club in Chicago called the Gate of Horn, where he sent her for a two-week residency singing in this show compared by Bob Gibson. And he was then a very big star. And Bob Gibson was curating, as we would now say, the Newport Folk Festival. And the bill was already full, but he knew that he could get this young singer on if he simply had her come on as his guest, which he did. So they sang two numbers together, Virgin Mary and We Are Crossing Jordan River. Virgin Mary, very slow, meditative song, which showed off her soprano. And then We Are Crossing Jordan River, this incredibly exciting performance, all rhythm. Sadly, there's no video, there's no, you know, film record of it, but the audio record certainly exists. And it is amazingly exciting still. Not quite pitch perfect, but really exciting. And when she kind of descended the stage, there was this kind of incredible fuss, and Fandango and Robert Shelton in the New York Times wrote that a star was born at the Newport Festival, this young, pure, achingly pure star. And suddenly everyone was offering a record contract.
A couple of years later, she makes a move to New York. She meets Dylan in 1961. How important was that meeting, not just professionally, but personally? What do you think the real nature of that relationship was?
Oh, well, they certainly had a relationship. I mean, it was, you know, the magazines of the time, of course, were all very excited and thinking what could come of the union of these two people. I think Grossman himself wondered that. They certainly had an affair, much of it conducted in New York at the old Hotel Earl on Washington Square, which is now the Washington Square Hotel. You could still stay in the room, and at her home in Carmel on the West Coast, where she had a cabin. The thing that people have to remember here, and the Dylan fans are very bad at it, she had seen her face on the cover of Time magazine when Dylan was still scrabbling for dimes in village coffee shops. You know, she was already, she had two or three albums in the charts. So when they met that night in Gurney's Folk City on West 4th Street, famously in the village, Greenwich Village, And she said, I want to sing some of your songs. And then she did. She began singing them on her first tour, big national tour, which was the Southern Campuses. And then, in fact, they were recorded live with God on Our Side, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, were two of the early ones. She really was able to bring him to a mass audience. And then, crucially, she introduced him at Newport 1963. She brought him on stage, returning the favour that Bob Gibson had done her. Wow. And then she... on a concert tour, and they did quite a few concerts together, and her audiences weren't necessarily pleased. You know, they'd come to hear this beautiful young soprano folk singer, and on came this growling minstrel. She won through in the end. I mean, she liked causes, and she recognised his talent, and she hoped he would be part of the kind of fight against injustice, and of course, it took her a long time to recognise that actually what he did was to give them the arsenal, the songs, but he didn't want to be at the barricades, and she has consistently been.
And that just on Joan Baez then, was that really her mission in life? Yes, singing was important, but was her mission really that activism? You know, obviously anti-Vietnam, you know, right up to the present day, she visited Bosnia. She was part of the Northern Ireland.
Yes.
She visited Northern Ireland during the time of the peace people, Betty Williams, at that particular time. Right across, you know, that latter part of the 20th century, she was behind so many different causes. Do you think that activism, in fact, was more important to her than her music, or what is the balance for you between the two?
Well, I think the two went absolutely hand. I mean, I said to her only recently, you know, you could have done opera, you know, with that voice, which I believe she could have done. She said, well, I wanted to keep my feet in the dirt, and she meant it sort of literally, metaphorically. But I think it was, I mean, she grew up, you know, she heard Martin Luther King speak when she was 16 years old, and she still cried when she talked about this profound, he was saying these things about nonviolence that she felt, but couldn't yet articulate. So I think I think the music and the social activism are really indivisible. I mean, she's given up, you know, she's retired formally from the concert stage. But it wasn't really until 1990 when, you know, she told me, and we were chatting in London, and she said that, well, you know, I'd quite like to bow out of a time of my choosing. You know, the Berlin Wall just come back down. It was a halcyon moment that, you know, things looked good. And she realised that if she wanted to kind of bow out and have a bit more of a career, she'd have to let some of the politics go. Having said that, she then almost immediately went to Sarajevo.
Yeah.
So she did. She managed to separate. So the concerts became much more concerts, and so political comment would be confined to songs, which she talked about.
And I don't know where I
want to... Deportee, for example, and talk about the refugees, you know.
I want to finish up with Forever Young, and I don't know how political or just how socially conscious or just how kind her recent performances of this song was. She was part of performing balcony style like the Italians, and Forever Young was the song that she chose.
What are you talking about? The kitchen songs?
Yes, the kitchen songs.
Yeah, she did a series of songs. Yeah, that was very moving in the little speeches she gave for all of them. And, you know, for Forever Young, which is, of course, a Bob Dylan song from his album Planet Waves, 1973, it's a kind of prayer in all but name. It's, you know, may your hands always be busy, your feet always be swift. You know, it's a prayer, a universal prayer, and she will be forever young. She's not 80 until January, actually. It's January the 9th, just to correct your intro.
Yes,
I hope she's now painting and raising money by other means and actively campaigning, of course.
Yeah. Young woman in her 70s. Let us not rush things on her.
She's got a bit more, yes.
We'll finish up with Forever Young, and this is not the version from the kitchen songs, but a version from earlier on. And thanks so much for speaking to us this evening. That's Elizabeth Thompson, author of the book Joan Baez, The Last Leaf, which is published by Palazzo. And let's have a little bit of Joan just to bring us to the ad break.
May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. And may you stay.
Felicia Olusanya, or Feli Speaks, is a Nigerian-Irish poet, performer and playwright from County Longford. She's been writing poetry from a young age, well-known name on the spoken word scene. Her powerful words have resonated with audiences at Electric Picnic, the National Concert Hall and the Abbey, and recently RTE's The Next Normal. She'll be part of Waterford's Imagine Arts Festival from tomorrow, and she joins me now to tell us more. Just bring us back to the early move, if you would, Felicia, to start out, that move from Nigeria to Ireland at the age of 8, and you spent spent some time in direct provision. Was that actually, was the direct provision, did that happen in Longford or did the Longford move happen subsequent to that?
Hi, how are you doing, Sean?
Not bad.
The move came afterwards, I'd say.
So tell us, you came to Ireland first and were in direct provision for a period of time. What brought yourself and your family here?
I think the vision of a better life, the vision of stability and the vision of being able to provide adequately for our family and ourselves was the reason for the move.
And then the move to Longford, which happened subsequent to the time in direct provision. What did you make of Longford when you got to know it? I know you were very young at the time. You were 8 years old, so you weren't. Well, what were you feeling? I don't know what you were feeling. Don't let me not say what you were or weren't feeling.
I suppose I was just adjusting. I was in a new place, new environment. So as a young child, I was just adjusting to the circumstances that, I found myself in. And that was like, okay, you're in a new town, you're going to new schools. And I suppose it was fine. I suppose because I was young enough, I could adapt easier. Mm.
At what point did writing become a part of what you were doing? I think you had notebooks that you had from quite a reasonably young age. When did that start and what sent you to write things down?
I suppose I was quite imaginative and I always enjoyed getting lost in the world of books. And I was pleasantly amused by how much could be created from things being written down. And I suppose I was inspired by, always being in the Longford Library, inspired by schools, the primary school I grew up in and my secondary school, and being able to explore art through plays, through writing and through performance. I think I found my love there, and being read to by my teachers, my fifth class teacher in particular, Mrs. Morris, she used to read to us quite often and she'd pick a particular book and we'd get lost in that world. So I think I'd been writing for as long as I can remember, perhaps about 11, 12 years old. I've been writing since then.
The particular themes you were writing about, I mean, there's quite, we've just been talking about Joan Baez and activism, but there's quite a, I suppose, a socio-political bent in much of what you've written, or certainly much of what I've seen and heard from you. Was that there from earlier on, or as a young teenager, were you writing about other material?
I think as a young teenager, you don't know enough about the world to write about. Well, when I was growing up anyway, now we have TikTok, but growing up, I suppose, I would write about things that were around me. So family, friends, emotions. Mm. I remember I found my old journal and I used to write about how angry and bad I was at math. So I think I wrote about a range of things and it was always about whatever I was feeling and deserved my attention the most. And I suppose in the social political range right now, as an adult, I think I've come to mature into that by learning about what the world is and different areas and facets that involve me and other people.
Yeah, well, interesting that you say you were writing about what was happening around you, what your experiences, in fact. And I want to play a piece called Still, which was part of the RTE's Next Normal series. And right now, or in recent months, you're still writing about what is happening around you. Let's have a listen to a little bit of Still.
Still. COVID came and Ireland stood still. Shocked at how much could gather at our doorsteps like dust. We wrestled with what we might, what we may, how life will continue and the ways it must. Stood still. The virus ate through limbs of every family tree. It choked out lives we've built roots around. It emptied out purses, cutting money by the foot, rendered hearts bruised, leaving persons forgotten, left us breathless, for dead. Still. We closed into ourselves. We folded behind lock and key, inhaled through fogs of uncertainty. We found fun in the walls of our homes, made it work, fashioned it for play, carved out sections to fill joy with so we can hold it firm on days we didn't know what was next, what could happen. Stood still for those whom age had known beyond a golden jubilee, whose eyes glazed with film reel memories, whose daughters have vowed to love them in their sunset, whose sons have kissed them in their sunrise. We want your vision of us in full color. Stood still for frontline workers armed with nothing but faith, for emerging minds that must dare to dream in high definition, for lonely minds that are glaring at love through a screen. For bodies that create homes in cardboard shelters. Still, for you, Ireland is standing still. But tomorrow, when our knees go soft with impatience and the gates of our homes swing open, which way would our legs go? Which path does our heart know?
And that's Felicia Olesanya, our Feli Speaks there, with a piece that we first heard on The Next Normal on RT1 a few weeks back. Seems so apt, Felicia, in terms of today and the fact that we're back in level five. How has that affected you in terms of your performing life?
It has affected me by, I suppose, restricting the use of like art venues and theatres. And obviously we can't perform right now on stage physically. So everything has kind of gone digitally in the past 6 months. And we've learned, I suppose, how to adapt in different creative ways, to what we're used to.
Although I did see you recently in The Great Hunger, the Abbey production of The Great Hunger, in the grounds of Emma. Now, that was adapting to
yes.
the current situation in a very different way. Had you much knowledge of Longford isn't that far away from the kind of landscape that Kavanagh talks about in his poem. Had you much knowledge of Kavanagh and his poetry before taking on the part that you play in the piece?
I think I had a little knowledge of him from poetry in secondary school, but not... not as intense as I've had to have learned for The Great Hunger, but it was thoroughly enjoyable, and I did enjoy the adaptation of having it on the immigrant grounds. So, yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Finally, then, just maybe you tell us a little bit about your We Are Griot, which is the collective that you're part of with Samuel Yakura. That is part of your event at the Imagine Arts Festival in Waterford this weekend.
So currently myself, Samuel Yakura and Leke Ogunde are part of Waterford Writers Weekend, and we excitedly pre-recorded in our way of adapting to COVID right now, pre-recorded for the event, and we're excited to show our talents and to speak about various things that affect us.
Well, listen, continued success, and I hope that we can see you back on stage live before too long. I know we've 6 weeks of this to think about, but let's support the online stuff that's happening. That's Felicia Olesanya there, Feli Speaks. And tomorrow evening's event that Felicia was telling us about, it'll be available to watch on imagineartsfestival.com. And that brings us to a close on this Thursday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Pather Carney. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. I will talk to you tomorrow night, once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. New albums from Bruce Springsteen, in fact, Gorillaz and Laura Veers. And we'll also be hearing from Ye Vagabonds, who have also been part of that adapting process. They're part of the Tradition Now event in the National Concert Hall on Saturday evening. So we'll hear more about that on tomorrow night's Arena.